Rollins has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins by near third. This game is over.
A complete game. What a performance by Cliff Lee.
Victorino in the alley calling. He's got it. And the Phillies are going back to the World Series.
Welcome to Continued Success. I am Justin Plume of FanGraphs and Baseball Prospectus. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Liz, the league divisional series is over in baseball. Your thoughts?
Feeling bad for the Rays is something I don't want to do, but I would have rather them win than the Astros. That was the game that happened last night.
This is a time of year where I don't know if you watch a baseball game, you kind of instinctively pick a team, you pick a side.
Yes, thank you. I tried to explain this to people, especially, you know, the baseball people that I work with. Some of them have been in the industry for a long time. They're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, how do you not? I can't watch a sporting event without picking a side, really.
I refuse to believe. So I feel like people who deny that are just trying to prove how cool and objective they can be. I refuse to believe that that's actually what's going on in their heads, that they're just like, oh, I'm perfectly balanced and I'm just enjoying the sport for what it is, or like, just I have a job and this is there's a color, there's a player, there's a shift in the wind, and at some point you're thinking, I'd rather this team win than that team. And I refuse to believe anyone is so objective that they don't succumb to that.
Exactly. Like, I have to pick a side. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you go through your history, you know, at least when you're not writing about it, you go through your history with the team and like, all right, can I, given everything that's happened in my life, what's in my brain, can I root for this team? I can't root for the Astros ever.
And that's the thing. I mean, you wind up with, and probably because there's a reason to legitimately hate every Major League Baseball team, but it just in the playoffs when there's like eight teams left, you're just like, wow, there's a reason that every one of these teams sucks. And the Rays and Astros both have pretty big reasons that they suck. Obviously the Braves and Cardinals both have reasons that they suck. The Yankees have what's the Twins' reason for sucking? I mean, maybe it's because they suck against the Yankees.
I mean, the Twins are the one team I don't have any reasons. There was some weirdness with that whole Miguel Sano thing last year. That was terrible, but it was also very weird. I don't really know how anyone could have handled that too much better. I just hated that it happened. So, like, my only reason for being angry at the Twins is put up a fight, you pussies.
I'm sorry.
Honestly, it's just...
Come on, guys.
Do better. Like, I feel so, I know. I don't know how it happened. I know a lot of Twins fans. Like, some of the guys that I go to the Sabre convention every year, two of them are Twins fans. I don't believe at any point they had hope that they really wanted their team to get past the division series, but I don't think any of them had hope because it was the Yankees. If they have to face the Yankees, they will lose.
Yeah, I mean, it's not cute, you know? It's like, win a game. Lose 3-1, but win a game. You know, this narrative is really hard to watch. And you know what? With so much going on yesterday, I had a post go up on FanGraphs that really I'd been working on for about a week, just because it was the anniversary of the ball Joe Mauer hit. That was clearly fair and called foul in the extra innings of a game in Yankee Stadium in the 2009 ALDS.
It's days before replay.
Mm-hmm. And Phil Cuzzy, who
doesn't
have a great history, does not have a great history, calls a clearly fair ball foul. And next inning, Mark Teixeira hits a walk-off home run. But, you know, Twins loaded the bases with no outs after the call and did not score. So,
and they did that a lot in their final game against the Yankees earlier this week. They started the game by, like, putting two on or loading the bases and then just their no runs. For a team that hit, like, a gazillion, like, they beat the Yankees in home runs over the regular season. Both of them hit a record. I believe the Twins hit like 308 and the Yankees hit 307. Like, there was just no offense for a team that had been so full of offense.
Yeah, that was supposed to be like a titanic offensive matchup. And instead we got
wet fart noise.
Unfortunately, nostalgic in all the wrong ways. Yankees Twins series. So that was just a kind of a big fat nothing. I gotta say, we haven't really had a chance to discuss the two NLDS series at length, or since they've ended, I guess. And boy, I mean, you know, if I'm looking at positives, of which there are none, but if I'm looking at positives, if any member of the 2019 Washington Nationals was going to hit a game-winning grand slam,
Howie Kendrick,
why not be the guy who is not only a former Philly, but is, you know, has a sparkling reputation, an awesome smile,
yes,
and had been just getting his ass kicked that entire series. Just three errors at first base, not great at the plate. When I looked away and looked back, and he was the one circling the bases, I couldn't believe it. Howie Kendrick in my mind isn't like the Nationals. Howie Kendrick is Howie Kendrick. He's been in the league forever, and him getting a hit like that in a moment like that, that is, you know, on its own, pretty cool. Even if you're rooting for the, I mean, not if you're a Dodgers fan, but if you're rooting for the Dodgers, just like as you or me being like, I want the Dodgers to win instead of the Nationals. Even then, it's pretty cool to see a guy like that get the big hit. So I guess that was kind of a silver lining.
I think so. I mean, I am angry at that game, angry at Dave Roberts, who will not be fired. So at least the Phillies won't be tempted to hire him.
Unbelievably stupid managing. Unbelievable.
Really, Sean, my husband, was asleep. You know, we were watching this in the bedroom because it was on late, and he was asleep next to me, and I'm just like jumping up, like sitting in bed, like bopping up and down. I'm like trying not to yell and like scream, whispering, like, what are you doing? It was, he tempted fate. I don't understand why he hate, like, I saw, I think someone said to me at one point, you know, in the playoffs, you trust one pitcher and everyone else is a mop-up guy.
Mm.
And for some reason, despite so much evidence, Clayton Kershaw is the guy that Dave Roberts trusts. He's the one who he trusts and he's the one who's going to call on. And that's not fair to Clayton Kershaw, because Clayton Kershaw is not the pitcher he used to be 3 years ago.
But that's not exactly true, because clearly Dave Roberts also trusts Joe Kelly.
Kelly.
Which just raises more questions, frankly.
I mean, really, that moment, the moment that Howie Kendrick, I mean, it was engineered by Dave Roberts, who you could argue was technically working for the Nationals at those moments.
That makes more sense than anything else.
It really does. I will say, Howie Kendrick, I mean, that's his Matt Stairs moment. He will never have to buy a drink in Washington again. I mean, that is. He sent them to their first, not the franchise's first, you know, LDS berth, but because the Expos had one, which, again, I really don't think the Expos should count.
No. I mean, there's a lot of credit taken by this Nationals franchise. Well, with, as
they've
far as
turned,
like,
their back on it largely. Right. It wasn't until this season that the Nationals started being like, oh, you know, people like the Expos kind of.
Well, we were
maybe
the
want
Expos.
To talk about that?
That was us. Yeah.
Like,
remember that?
They haven't talked about it at all. And as soon as then, like, this is their second, you know, franchise, you know, trip to the championship series, I'm like, that can't, no.
There's, you know what? I was walking down the street yesterday, thinking about that, well, not yesterday, whenever this game was, and thinking about the game, and I was like, you know what the word is? The word is bratty. I really just can't get past that. Like, the Nationals organization and so many, like, Nationals fans in this context, it's just bratty. It's like, oh, we barely existed for 5 minutes. We deserve everything. It's been so hard. And, like, that's what I can't stand about it. Like, that's just the personality, the vibes they give off. Now,
see,
you know,
me in another 9,000 losses, assholes. Like, yeah. Come on.
Well, in any case, the Dodgers are out. I don't know how your World Series bracket is looking, but
no,
mine is gone.
I had them in the World Series. I had them winning the World Series. And
I think I did, too.
I really feel like I'm never going to be able, even if they make it back next year, which I feel like the spirit has been punched out of this Dodgers team. So maybe not next year. But if they do, I'm never going to be able to choose them to win another series because I no longer trust Dave Roberts to do anything right. I don't see how any... I mean, people are going to blame Kershaw, and I feel bad about that because I don't think it's entirely his fault.
No. You know,
he could have pitched better, but he is who he is, and Dave Roberts could have sent out his entire... They didn't play a game the day before. The entire bullpen was rested.
What is it, Liz, tell me, what is it that managers think they're going to accomplish by sending a guy out for a second inning like that? Whether it's Clayton Kershaw or Joe Kelly, because that's quite the gambit to run between those two pitchers alone in a single game, a single elimination game. We've seen Gabe Kapler do that multiple times, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm pretty sure he's 0 for 100 in pitchers coming back out to pitch a second inning of relief. What is it you think you're saving yourself a bullpen arm by doing that? I mean, it seems like it's a risk with no payoff every time, and they take it and it blows up in their faces.
I think at least in Dave Roberts' mind, he was probably looking like, all right, well, he got that out. The bases were loaded with, two outs. Kershaw got the big out. I'm going to send it back out. He must have liked the matchups in the first two batters, which he threw, I think, one pitch to each of them. And they both went over the fence. I think that it was still a dumb decision. I mean, because you don't use, I think part of it is, you don't use Clayton Kershaw for one batter. It's Clayton Kershaw. You use him. He's one of the greatest pitchers of our generation. You don't send him out for just one batter, which is dumb. Your job is to win a game, not respect your players in that overall historical sense. Mm-hmm. Your job is to win a game, not make sure that their reputation, as the greatest pitcher is intact. But I can see that decision has slightly more defendability than sending Joe Kelly out for another inning because that's the one decision that is completely and totally indefendable because the lead was gone. It was a tied game and Joe Kelly barely got through the previous. I mean, I think he struck out the side in that inning, but I'm like, good, you used him. Now he's done. Sit him down and bring up Kenta Maeda or Adam Kolarik. The entire bullpen was rested. Everyone. I have a feeling a bunch of dudes didn't do their side work that day in anticipation of needing to come in an emergency. Davey Martinez asked a bunch of his starters, made sure everyone was ready to go no matter what. I don't understand why you'd send Joe Kelly, who fucked up shit for the Red Sox. I don't know why you'd send him out again. Because it was immediately obvious what was going to happen.
It's crazy that Joe Kelly's been, it's like he's the main character of playoff baseball of late, and he's just like why is Joe Kelly, why have we seen so much Joe Kelly?
Have like some kind of spell casting ability. It's the only thing I could think of.
So that was, hey, you know what? Three of the four series went to five games. That's just about as a baseball fans whose team is not in the postseason, that's about as close to as much as you can ask as anything. That game where the Rays won at home to push that series to five games was a really good game. Like maybe not like a great back and forth game, but like that they won it and that environment at the Trop was really awesome and loud. Like that was something that was fun to watch. And then there were a couple of really good games. And there were a couple of really, really bad games, including the elimination game for the Atlanta Braves for many, many reasons.
Now, I'd like to say that was actually a great game for me.
Yeah, when I say bad, I mean massively enjoyable. But like if, again, from the perspective of someone who's like, I'm going to sit down and enjoy the majesty of baseball tonight and then watch the Cardinals drop 10 runs on the Braves in the first inning while circus music plays, that's not going to be as enjoyable for them. But for you and I, Liz, that was probably the best playoff game, most satisfying playoff game I've seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. Going into that game, yeah, we're going to talk about it. So the narrative going into that game, one of them anyway, was Cardinals reliever Ryan Helsley, who is a member of the Cherokee Nation, was asked by a reporter, did not go find a microphone, what he how he viewed the Braves' tomahawk chop, which every time they are featured I'm going to say in the postseason because then it's on a national level, but you know, all throughout history, not just in moments where they reach the postseason, is typically, you know, called out by people for being racist and being offensive because obvious reasons. The Braves in general got a lot of work to do in that department as an organization. But, you know, that's something you're going to get argued with about if you bring it up because, you know, oh, it's been wrong forever and you don't know the history, blah, blah, blah.
It's history is racism.
Long story short,
it literally always was.
Yeah, long story short, that's not really an argument. A reporter asked Ryan Helsley, again, a member of Cherokee Nation, who what he thought about it, and he said, "You know, I think it's a misrepresentation of the Cherokee people or Native Americans in general. It's not me being offended by the whole mascot thing. It's not. It's about the misconception of us, the Native Americans, and it devalues us and how we're perceived in that way or used as mascots. That's the disappointing part." The stuff like this still goes on. It's just disrespectful, I think. And that's what he told that to the St. Louis Dispatch. And, you know, hey, that's a pretty accurate and measured take on that.
Well said. You know, I don't think he thought about, you know, like, God, I have to say something about this. What am I going to say? Like, for off the cuff, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And, you know, the Braves had been not only doing the tomahawk chop music as they have throughout every baseball game they play nonstop. It's like their only move is to play this music and have fans do the chop. And they, of course, were handing out foam tomahawks as playoff, you know, little things for fans to wave when they came into the stadium. So in response to what Ryan Helsley said, the Braves released a statement saying, out of respect for the concerns expressed by Mr. Helsley, we will take several efforts to reduce the tomahawk chop during our in-ballpark presentation today. Among other things, these steps include not distributing foam tomahawks to each seat and not playing the accompanying music or using chop-related graphics. That's great. Hey, that's what it... Oh, wait, hang on. It continues. Hang on. When Mr. Helsley is in the game. Oh. Interesting, huh?
All I'm hearing is the Price is Right loser noise.
I love it because it's just like racism, which is a personal issue for only Mr. Ryan Helsley, will be dealt with exclusively when he is in the game. And if fans want to approach him for an in-person apology, he will be in the Cardinals bullpen, you know, if you want to yell down to him or something. So terrible. The asinine way to go about that. Like, don't address it at all if that's the best you got, honestly.
The news about this came out sort of slowly. First it was, you know, they won't be putting the foam tomahawks on the chairs. I'm like, well, that's meaningless, essentially, but okay. It's literally the least they can do while still being seen, but still looking like they're doing something. And they're like, well, then we're not going to play it. You know, we're going to reduce the amount that we're going to play it. I'm like, okay. And then the full statement came out. I'm like, oh, so it's nothing. They're doing nothing. Like, they're just singling out this guy and making it so that when he comes into the game, the fans will supply the chop. Because I love how they think they can just stop the fans from doing it by not playing the music.
Oh my God.
The chop music. Like, fans will do that at other stadiums. Mm-hmm. Groups of Braves fans. They tried to, I think I've heard them do it at Citizens Bank Park. I've heard them do it at Citi Field. Like, they'll do it everywhere they go. And there's no music there. Fans have been conditioned to do this with or without the cue music. So they were just sort of singling him out and making it so when he gets into the game, it'll be like his Twitter mentions, but in person.
Yeah, Ryan Helsley did not enter the game, so the Braves never took a playoff as far as all that stuff goes anyway. And there was also you bring up the fans doing the chop. First of all, you know, the Braves mentioning him and saying it was because of him, so cowardly, using him as a human shield. It's so bad. And you know that if he had entered the game, that fans who were making it clear on Twitter that they were ready to do this would have just hit him with the tomahawk, an even more adamant and enthusiastic tomahawk chop than they would have done otherwise, for the exclusive purpose of trolling him or getting him. And, you know, that, there was a Braves beat writer who was like, oh, you really think that they would, oh, said that would be utterly reprehensible. And I can't imagine that. How like, unaware and naive about how people, how trolling works, how Twitter works, how people like get off in that scenario.
Yeah, we're gonna name this guy. It's Dave O'Brien, who
right. I couldn't remember.
Yeah,
his
name. Dave O'Brien, who now works for The Athletic. He's a naive moron. He can come fight me if he doesn't like me saying that, because that is him acting like that. Has he ever interacted with a stadium full of fans? Has he ever been to a Braves game? Does he understand the psychology of fans? Because, I mean, Phillies fans, we don't have a standard racist thing that happens every game. But I wouldn't doubt that Phillies fans would be assholes to an opposing player who said, I find the Fanatic to be cultural appropriation of the Galapagos Islands.
You don't think we would do
that? Oh, no, I do.
I was going to say, we absolutely would do that.
No, 100%. Like, it's fan psychology. And for him to be like, no, how would they ever do that? I'm like, are you, like, it's like, I feel like someone who doesn't understand fan psychology after being a beat writer for that long is either being willfully stupid, and if he's not, he should just be fired.
It was pretty massively dense. Like, it willful ignorance, I guess. It was like, oh, yeah. Just look around you. Look down in your mentions. People are saying, like, no, the opposite is true. I am a Braves fan, and, like, here I am pasting a video of the tomahawk chop in my effort to say this is what I'm going to do if Ryan Helsley comes into the game. Like, it's really not that hard of a train to follow.
Your
so,
culture is a joke to me.
Mm-hmm,
your culture is something I yell at a baseball game. Like, I don't.
Taking that away from me is worse than anything that's happened to Native Americans, is basically what statement there. And it's disgusting. So that sucked.
But what didn't suck was what came next.
And then the game happened. Braves got utterly pounded in the first inning, as we were all very happy to see. Unfortunately, it was the Cardinals, but whatever. And
they're less unlikable than they were.
Are they?
I don't know. I mean, I watched all those games as a team. There was that incident with Carlos Martinez, their closer, who he sucks as a closer. But he also was angry at Ronald Acuna for, you know, sort of maybe what he thought was showboating. It didn't seem like, what's weird is it didn't seem like most of the rest of the team sort of backed him up on that. Like, usually Yadier Molina would be out there yelling in someone's face about it, but he just sort of tried to calm everyone down. You know, they're young. The only player who's left from that era that we hate is Chris Carpenter. Or no, wait, Adam Wainwright. Chris Carpenter has been gone for a long time.
Yeah, the other one. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know why I get them mixed up, but Adam Wainwright, who earlier, you know, who threw like a masterful game at one point. He, you know, it made me feel very nostalgic for the Roy Halladay of old. And so I don't hate them. I have, like, a lot of my anger in baseball is now dedicated to hating owners and disliking how capitalism has taken over baseball in its effort to make sure the players are paid as little as possible. And so I don't have as much room for the old grudges as I used to. And maybe this is the sign of that, because I would rather hate the Braves and then hate capitalism rather than spend time hating the Cardinals for something that happened like almost a decade ago now. So I don't know. Sure. I feel like maybe some of the old hate is gone, but I guess faced with these choices, I would rather root for the Cardinals than anything else.
Much rather, in the context of 2019, root for the Cardinals over the Braves. But my anger at the Cardinals has very little to do with 2011 anymore. That's not really it. It's more just that. Let me do this. I'm gonna read you the last night. Gerrit Cole pitched masterfully against the Astros, and after the game, he gave an interview on the field, and he said, a lot of credit to our opponent, the Rays. What an unbelievable season for them to sustain the injuries that they have and to win as many games as they did in the AL East. I really don't know how they did it. What a hard-fought series. They didn't give up a pitch, which is really a credit to their approach and their tenacity. I thought they played great. Obviously, their bullpen was locked down. Kevin Cash did a great job managing. They really stepped up to the plate more often than not, and they really played a great series, so a lot of credit to them.
What a nice guy.
Oh, yeah, it was, it was wonderful.
So nice.
Everyone was like, oh.
Come to Philly, nice
surprise. Like, okay, thanks. All right, great.
Well, no, it's not just the same platitudes you hear. Like, he really, yeah.
I don't think they asked him. I think he was just saying that in the interview. So compare that to...
Oh, no.
Jack Flaherty talking about after the Cardinals beat the Braves in that series, where he was talking about the pitch you talked about going in on Ronald Acuna, whether or not that was on purpose when they were already up like 13-1. We were trying to go in. We've got two strikes on him. We were trying to go in. If we're going to go in, we're going to go in tight. It hit him. He took exception to it. That's the guy he wants to be. That's how it is. He's been having all his antics all series. The guy hits a ball off the wall. He gets a single out of it. So he wants to take exception to it. He can do whatever he wants. He can talk all he wants. But we tried to go in. We talk. Our scouting report is go in. We go in. So it got away. It hit him. He wants to take exception to it. He can do whatever he wants. Not sure what the... ball off the wall part has to do with anything, but clearly Jack Flaherty takes issue with the way Ronald Acuna plays, which a lot of people took issue with the way Ronald Acuna plays.
Those people
which,
are stupid.
Very dumb. You know how many times Ronald Acuna was called out for his you know, quote-unquote antics in game one of this series, a game in which he went 3-for-5 and hit a 2-run home run and was one of the only reasons the Braves like almost made a comeback to win the game. So that's what I'm talking about when I say really in regards to the Cardinals. There's you know it's funny the names and faces change, same old Cardinals.
Really?
You know?
Like, yeah. Thank you for reminding me about how stupid they are. You know, I mean, I'm rooting for them because rooting for the Nationals makes me feel like jumping off of the building. I can't do it, so I have to put it all with the Cardinals. I mean, I said on Twitter, I've even gone soft on Yadier Molina, who I used to hate. Mm-hmm. He's really one of the last players of that generation of players, that Chase Utley, Joe Mauer, you know, Chris Carpenter, you know, sort of mid-Roy Halladay kind of generation. Those players are almost all gone.
Yeah.
Like Jacoby Ellsbury, who even knows where he is? You know, the fact that Dustin Pedroia hasn't officially retired yet is bonkers. You know, neither of them have played a game this season. So, you know, I have some love for him. You know, I found it adorably corny, the profanity-laced tirade that Mike Schilt went on.
Yeah, I almost used that, but then I was like, that's not fair, because I actually loved that, and also, that was in the locker room. I don't think he knew he was, that wasn't like an interview, like, compared to the Gerrit Cole interview. That was like, that's not really fair. That was a locker room
speech. It was, you know, and I really kind of adored that.
Me too.
You know, like, it's exactly what you want to say to your players after they won this hard series, after they came back, after they faced elimination. You know, it's exactly what you want to say to fire them, like, we can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Braves came up with all their swagger and we stomped them down. Like, there was a lot of that in there, too. But I can't hate it. They won. They beat them.
Yep.
You know, the Nationals play with a fair amount of swagger. And I wonder how much they're going to enjoy Juan Soto. Probably not very much. I hope they hate him.
The Nationals do a dance in the dugout every time they hit a home run.
Which I really hate that I love. I hate that I love it because it's really cute. Oh, you have to hit a lot of home runs to be able to come up with a dance like that. Phillies, get on it.
Well, we're going to use at least a part of this show today to talk about 2009 playoffs like we are supposed to do on this podcast. So we're going to start that and talk a little more about some topics of our interest right after this first break. Well, that's what was happening in the league divisional series this year. Not the worst bout of playoff baseball we've seen of late. We're not getting stuck with the most likable of playoff rooting options, but hey, you know, it's been It's been a pretty okay postseason thus far, and I think that's going to continue. Liz, obviously the Phillies made some moves recently that are shaking things up a bit. We talked about Gabe Kapler being dismissed last night on an emergency episode of Hittin' Season. Something we didn't mention was a tweet from Andy Martino. He used to write for the Inquirer. He now covers the Yankees and Mets for the SNY Network. And he tweeted something that was a little, involved Gabe Kapler that was worth noting, I think. He said, in regards to Dave Roberts, who is going to keep his job with the Dodgers, but in regards to, at that point, the prospect of Roberts not keeping his job, Andy Martino tweeted, "This raises a question I wondered about today, Kapler and Dodgers. Before Roberts was hired, players, including Kershaw, raised very strong objections to Kapler, I was told. How much leverage does Kershaw have now?" So Martino's bringing this up because I think he's more talking about the career of Clayton Kershaw, how much influence he wields despite not being the pitcher he used to be, how he factors into the Dodgers' futures plans, and how loudly his voice would be heard in the event of them selecting a new manager, which they, again, are not going to be doing. But he obviously brings Gabe Kapler into it and says, you know, when apparently the Dodgers were thinking or considering Gabe Kapler as an option for a managerial role of some kind, and Kershaw was apparently very, very much against that. Had we heard this before, Liz?
I hadn't. I posted it in our Hittin' Season Slack, and I'm like, this is interesting. I really wonder what they thought, what the objections were, because it's not like we can't understand them. I feel like a guy like Kapler would drive Clayton Kershaw insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, what we've heard about Kapler's time with the Dodgers has you know, largely the most prominent news stories about that era that we've heard have not been good. Mm-mm. Have not shown Gabe Kapler in the best light. We don't know if those two things are like Martino's tweet about Kershaw and the story about when Gabe Kapler was the director of player development for the Dodgers are related, but. You're just seeing another hint of a tumultuous time on top of the story that surfaced last, was it the off season? I guess, yeah, in the off season before 2019. Obviously, the I assume still ongoing Nick Francona story, which is has been a mess that's followed Gabe Kapler around quietly or loudly, depending on the timing. And now just a little tidbit like this, it just raises questions about what exactly was going on over there and what it was Gabe Kapler did to be such a, well, again, a polarizing figure, but it seems like four different kinds of reasons might have existed over there. I don't know. It raises more questions, but I don't know. Questions aren't what you want to have about somebody who, you know, at that point. I think Gabe Kapler was still the Phillies manager at that point. Maybe yeah. Not. It was no. He tweeted that yesterday at 6 o'clock. So no, he was not their manager at that point. But it kind of, you know, in my view, and I think probably, correct me if I'm wrong, yours as well. That's an era of Gabe Kapler's career that seems like it might have a few more details that come to light, and we'll just have to see what we see when they do.
Yeah, I'm eager to see what happens from here. I'm eager to see what comes out about him. I don't know if players will say things and put their name to it, if they'll say things and nothing will be attached to it. It seemed like he had a lot of love and respect from players in the locker room, but mm-hmm. I also feel like the flip side of that is it was love and respect because he let them do whatever they wanted. Because, you know, he was, you know, he would stand up for them. He wouldn't crap on them in the media, you know, but, you know, he wouldn't even say, you know, Reese needs to work on this or whatever. Like, I feel like they loved him the same way, you know, a high school student loves the teacher who lets them, you know, sit on the ground in a circle or takes class outside and lets them call him by his first name. I feel like that's the kind of love that the Phillies had for Kapler, because he was letting them get away with stuff that they hadn't been able to get away with in other clubhouses.
Yeah.
So I'm eager to see what happens from here. I mean, not just in Kapler's career, but what comes out about him, if anything, because that locker room was quiet
yeah.
during the 2 years that he was there. And I would like to see, I'm eager to see what happens with literally anybody else in that position next year.
There's obviously we know absolutely nothing that happened, you know, on a we have very little idea what went on in the Phillies clubhouse this year. As you said, we know even less, Liz and I, about what happened when Gabe Kapler was with the Dodgers. It just the things that come out, the stuff that gets hinted at, the reports that you see, you know, the true or not, that just stuff, the stuff that has come out has been like tough to find a connecting tissue. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's either guys who are like, oh, yeah, we loved and had a great time with Gabe here, or guys who are adamantly against him having a managerial position, or stories that do not paint him in a good light. Like it's just kind of tough to find like what was the deal out there, and what is Gabe Kapler's deal, which again was tough to figure out when he was given PR marketing jargon in a lot of interviews and keeping the clubhouse doors welded shut otherwise. So yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I woke up today and the first day of the Gabe Kapler era, and I was like, oh, huh, that's right. This is no longer a thing. And I think what I settled on, and I think John Stolness shared this view the other night, was that I am really glad. I really hope whoever the next manager is, we can stop talking about the Phillies manager.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that stops being the main character in all these stories, because there's only so much interest to be gleaned from talking about a manager, what a manager's job is, how good a manager is doing at their job. And you just much rather talk about the baseball players on this baseball team than the guy who's setting the lineup. And I feel like we've been doing nothing but talking about the manager for 2 years, which is absurd because it's not true. We were definitely talking about Bryce Harper for large chunks of that, but it doesn't feel like it anymore. Like it just gets buried under all of the stuff related to Gabe Kapler.
Yeah, it's all the Kapler narrative that sort of took over, because, you know, we were talking about his decisions and whether they were good or bad, the type of things you would talk about with, you know, talk about when, you know, I say a regular manager, which is not quite what I mean, but, you know, with managers, period. But everything around it, just, I mean, his personality and the way he is, the way he presents himself, the words he chooses to use when he says things, that kind of put a whole other layer in between, you know, the regular narrative and us. There was like an extra layer of crap to get through before you got to the baseball stuff. And I just think it's a case where it was not a good fit. It wasn't a good fit. And I don't know. I'm glad it's over. Oh my God, I'm glad it's over.
You know what somebody who's sick of talking about Gabe Kapler would do is talk about something else. So I think that's what we're going to do now. Liz, the 2009 NLDS was hilarious.
Yes, it was.
We're gonna travel back in time 10 years, as we used to do a little more on this podcast. We got a little sidetracked the past couple of weeks talking about what was going on or not going on with the Phillies. But this week, we're going to hit it. 2009, you know, what we remember most about that season is the postseason, and that was underway at this point. And yes, like I said, this NLDS was hilarious. It had four games. The first two were at 2:30 in the afternoon. The next one was at 10 p.m. And the next one was at 6:30. Those 2:30 starts were so fucking rude, Liz. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Cole Hamels agrees with me. He told the Philadelphia Inquirer, I don't think it's fair. I definitely don't think it's fair for the fans, because this is all about home field advantage. I understand TV ratings, but I think at the end of the day, most players would rather play when they're both comfortable, and that's kind of what we're trained at, either 1 o'clock or 7 o'clock. That's more fair for us than the TV ratings, because I don't think we mind as much for TV ratings. We want to get ourselves to the World Series and win it, and that's all that matters. It's not how much money we can make in the process of playing this game, because being a world champ, that's what we really live for. Now, you know, was this quote kind of rambling and strange in some ways? Yes, but you know, that's a classic Cole Hamels. You just kind of, you know, you get the answer, and then you also kind of smile, like, what are you talking about, man?
It's adorable. And he's like, this game isn't about making money.
Yeah, we live for being a world champ. Like, well, yeah, of course, bud. Like, I wouldn't have guessed that you cared about start times to make more money. That would have been crazy.
I mean, I have to say, I mean, the 2:30 start time is terrible.
Terrible.
But also, the division series, there are a number of days where you have to cram four of them in.
Sure.
And someone gets the short shrift. Having them do twice. It twice is real shitty. Like, that's unnecessary, but one team usually has to take a crappy afternoon start. Like, it, you know, it stinks, but there are four games to play on a national stage, and you have to do that. Like, that's not, it's not even necessarily about money. It's how, do you want to be playing until Thanksgiving?
You heard it here first, folks. Liz slaps down Cole Hamels from 10 years ago. I love you, Cole. His opinions on game start. Wow, I thought you were a big fan of his. Turns out, worst enemy.
Actually, I've been running over my Cole Hamels jersey with my car.
Start games at 2:30. Boo. So the Phillies scored 20 runs in this series, 8 of them in the 6th inning, their magical inning. They also scored 4 times in the 9th, which played a role, as you might imagine. Liz, on game one, the Bacon brothers, Kevin and the other one, sang the national anthem.
God, I forgot this was the time of the Bacon brothers.
The time of the Bacon brothers.
Oh, Kevin. Yeah. Kevin and what's his face?
And, you know, we all remember Roy Halladay's first ever playoff appearance and what happened there. But we don't talk a whole lot about the fact that 1 year prior to that, Cliff Lee threw his first playoff start ever. And it was just a couple of hits away from being just as impressive as Roy Halladay's. Lee didn't allow a base hit from the second frame to the middle of the 7th inning. He retired 16 straight batters in that stretch. He threw a complete game. And almost got the shutout, if not for a two-out, two-strike Troy Tulowitzki double in the 9th. The only Rockies run that team would score in a 5-1 Phillies win. So, I mean, that was Cliff Lee, I guess he was just, I mean, he was typically dominant. It just happened that he didn't throw a no-hitter. I guess the answer is probably nothing, but what would have happened if Cliff Lee threw a no-hitter in 2009 to open the playoffs and then Roy Halladay did it again in 2010? Would we just, would we all have just transcended to some other?
I was literally just saying, I think we all would have died.
Yeah, I mean, you just miss having that kind of pitching. Watching Garrett Cole last night was, yeah, another example of like, boy, I really miss having a pitcher who moves at his pace, who's getting batters out, who like, it just is dominating the other team. Like, that game last night was never any question. Garrett Cole just owned that game. And that's exactly the kind of game Cliff Lee would typically pitch. And for the most part, playoffs were no exception. A couple of huge exceptions to that in the playoffs. But, yeah, you know, it was, you know, they talk about pitching coming into a higher focus in baseball and that making it a less fun game to watch. I think there's definitely some credence to that. But I, you know, watching Cliff Lee pitch was never boring. No. And part of that was because he just kept the tempo so fast.
Yeah, it was the tempo. It was the attitude. Like, you try and compare him and Roy Halladay and they have just such different attitudes on the mound, but both of them are fascinating to watch because they're both very quick. You know, they saw themselves as, you know, no one's going to tell me what I'm supposed to do. You know, I've already figured all this out with my catcher. Stay out of my way. Don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And I loved it. You know, I love guys who exude that. Like, it's why I have a love-hate relationship with Max Scherzer, who I actually really dislike. But he's such a good pitcher with that same give me the ball attitude, that same you're going to have to hold me back from pitching another inning attitude that I just really adore. So Cliff Lee this is going to be his first year on the Hall of Fame ballot coming up.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he is a Hall of Famer, but it will be nice to revisit his career. Because I think he just disappeared. I don't think he wants to come back into the...
I was going
to
say, you think that'll pull him out of the woods?
No, I don't. I mean, if he was... I mean, maybe if he was, you know, elected to the Hall of Fame, which he won't be, maybe he would. But I don't think he wants to, and that's fine. That is... Just go.
Totally fine. Yeah. Well, we're going to take our second commercial break before we finish talking about this series. So we'll be right back to 2009 right after this. Well, Liz, Cliff Lee threw that dominant start, and he did it with the wind swirling in crisp autumnal glee, the air thick with fervor and garbage, like hot dog wrappers and plastic bags. We all know, of course, that just means Philadelphia is excited about something.
Philadelphia.
The weather would play a role in game one of the NLDS between the Phillies and Rockies in 2009. With the wind taking control of just about any ball hit in the air and doing whatever the hell it wanted with it. The first batter of the game was Dexter Fowler, who sent Jason Wirth a fly ball that seemed reasonable until it suddenly surged many feet behind him and he suddenly had to rush back to the warning track to catch it.
Dexter Fowler?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know why I thought he made his debut much later than he did, because it just seems like, wow, because he's on the Cardinals currently.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely a veteran now. And not a lot of the guys playing in this game are still around. So Wirth was tested again in the second inning on a Yorvi Torrealba fly ball, stumbling backwards to catch it and then nailing the runner at third, who thought he could take advantage of Wirth being swept off his feet. The wind slapped down a sure thing home run of Wirth's as well, giving him only a triple that, had he not been admiring it, could have been the first inside the park home run in postseason Phillies history. Ooh. Though third base coach Sam Perlazzo said he would have held Wirth regardless.
I don't know if Wirth would have listened to him.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, you know Jason Wirth's reputation, obeying the rules. Yes. That's, yeah. Cliff Lee became the fourth pitcher in playoff history and the first in the last 14 years to steal a base after he singled and took advantage of Ubaldo Jimenez's laborious delivery.
I always forget how much fun he had in the National League.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was, yeah, I think that was a huge deal for him to be traded over to the league where he'd actually get to try and contribute on offense. Game two of the NLDS saw Aaron Cook of the Rockies take on Cole Hamels, and of course the most 2009 Cole Hamels game possible occurred. The Rockies scored their first run on a ground ball that was going up the first baseline but was misplayed by Cole Hamels, and then Hamels gave up a home run to Torrealba, who hadn't hit a home run since May 6th.
No!
A sack fly later, it was 4-0. And then, you know what? Heidi Hamels went into labor. And Cole had to leave.
I forgot about this, yeah.
Yeah, me too. So Cole left, and as you can imagine, the responses were understanding and congratulatory with no dumb things said whatsoever.
How dare you attend the birth of your child? Don't you care about the bets that I've made on the playoffs?
Yeah. So, two Phillies fan stories were reported on this day as well. One guy, a 56-year-old man, complained after Carlos Ruiz's bat flew into the stands and hit him in the wrist, but he didn't get to keep the bat.
Oh.
The guy behind him grabbed it and traded it. This made no sense to me. The guy behind him got it and then traded it to the Phillies for a used bat, which is weird considering the bat that hit him was also used.
It might
so
be
clearly
certified. I can't imagine that happening today. It hit the person that it hit. Like, how did the guy that took the bat not get beaten to death?
I mean, isn't that amazing? Like, to be struck by a flying bat so hard that it clatters away from you enough that someone else can grab it and then you don't get it? That sucks.
No, I would have gone up to that person and threatened to punch them in the face.
Give me that bat hit you with it. the 56-year-old man who was hit with the bat said, "My watch was busted off my wrist. Probably saved my wrist from being broken, but I didn't care. I just wanted the bat. Tell Ruiz to get 3 hits in the next game. Then give me his bat. My wrist is sore. I deserve one."
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Then he went back to his row home.
Making demands. I love it. Ow, I got hurt at a baseball game. I held all the cards. Also happening on this day, a young girl won a lawsuit, not against Ryan Howard, but for a Ryan Howard ball. I also couldn't really make sense of this one. This is from the Philadelphia Inquirer, a 12-year-old Florida Marlins fan. First of all, I'm raising issue
yeah.
that is someone who exists. But a 12-year-old Florida Marlins fan won a lawsuit in Miami this week to get back Ryan Howard's record-setting 200th career home run baseball, which she'd caught during a July 16th game at Dolphin Stadium. A Phillies representative had talked this young girl into trading her baseball for another that was autographed by Howard, whose homer made him the fastest player in history to reach 200 homers. Weird, man. And it's easy to believe that this 12-year-old girl at the center of this wasn't maybe the one making a stink over which Ryan Howard baseball she got to keep. You know what I mean? Like, she got one that was signed by him. I mean, that's pretty cool. And like, if I'm 12 years old, I'm not thinking so far ahead. Like, oh, but I wanted the record setting one. Like, it just feels like there's an adult in the shadows here.
Oh, for
who's
sure.
Like, oh, we could definitely sell that on a memorabilia site or something. And also, what lawsuit was filed and then successfully used to get that keepsake away from Ryan Howard. I mean, I don't understand how that could have happened either.
Well, I covered this year, Albert Pujols got his 3,000th hit or something like that, and it was a home run in Detroit, and a guy caught it and did not want to give it back. And team officials and ushers and whatnot are directed to get those balls back at any cost. Because those are important to the team or the player or the Hall of Fame. You know, those balls can't, once they leave, if they don't return to the possession of the team, they can't be certified. But team officials will hand over anything. Like he was offered like $25,000 by someone, I believe related to the team. He was offered meet and greets and, you know, packs of tickets, and he just did not want to give it back. And he reported at the time, he said, I felt pushed around. I felt pushed around. I felt the team did not like it. I'm like, I caught the ball. It's mine. That's how it works at every single stadium. And so I can kind of get how they could have felt pressured to exchange it for something that they didn't want. I also don't think the kid had a lot to do with this. I mean, maybe they did. Kids are precocious and weird, and maybe that, you know, this 12-year-old girl, a Marlins fan, really wanted this ball, but it probably was one of her parents saying, this is a much more valuable ball for us to have, and it was ours to begin with. And I mean, I'm amazed that it went to a lawsuit, but I guess the Phillies really didn't want to give it up. Or Ryan Howard didn't want to give it up.
Yeah, I feel like Ryan just has... I mean, I'm not going to be able to cite specific occurrences. It just feels like Ryan got screwed a lot in, like, silly little things like this for some reason.
It really does.
Yeah. Well, in any case, the Phillies, fresh off having their 8-game home postseason win streak snapped with the Rockies winning game 2 of the NLDS, they headed to Colorado, where it was 20 degrees. And the weather was the narrative of the day once they landed in Denver, eclipsing Pedro Martinez's first playoff start with the Phillies, which wound up not happening. The players would ride a bike in the tunnel if they got cold. The traveling secretary had brought the winter wardrobe from back east. Hand warmers would be dispersed, and mostly they'd just play baseball. An absurd concept to any of those covering the game, apparently. Brad Lidge said he believed that if it were under 30 degrees with any kind of precipitation in the air, quote, they should bang it. And of course, he'd pitched in conditions like that, so, you know, the previous year. So he gets to say that, I think. Check this out. Back in Philly, a 22-year-old dumbass had been kicked out of game 2 for inappropriate behavior. So on his way out of the ballpark, somehow, this story, you know, I keep saying these make no sense to me. This story makes the least sense as far as letting someone do something. On his way out of the ballpark, somehow, he stops by an office where he asks to apply for a job. This is a guy wearing beaded necklaces, red face paint, and what the Daily News called a ghoulish mask that read Rocky's Killer. So, naturally, they give him a job application, and he sits there filling it out for 8 minutes. While he's doing that, he spots a manila envelope, steals it, and gets back into a waiting car. Turns out inside, 3 $1,100 replica World Series rings designed for team employees. The perfect crime.
In an envelope?
Except, as I said, he had just finished filling out a piece of paper with his name and home address on it.
Oh my God.
So the cops had a pretty easy time of showing up there the next day around 1 in the afternoon and arresting his stupid
what
ass.
The fuck? That is...
This was after a janitor had also been charged with stealing a World Series ring from a bathroom the previous month. I mean, people were thirsty for these rings, man. You can't just leave that stuff lying around. Everybody wants a part of that. Oh, I lived in Philadelphia during the Phillies World Series. Where's my ring? Oh, this one must be mine. There must have been some confusion. This one's
left
mine.
Left it in the bathroom for me. Wow.
How do you leave your World Series ring in the bathroom, too? Just for the record.
I don't know. Philadelphia is not known for its criminals, I guess. Jesus, I can't believe I'm going to fill out this application on my way from getting kicked out. First off, I don't understand how he was allowed to leave the stadium himself.
Yeah. Why? What path did he take where he wound up going into a place where there was job applications waiting? I mean,
where even is that? I'm trying to think of the stadium. Like 10 years ago, it wasn't exactly the same. But
I don't know. It's crazy.
Where? I mean, is it an office? It can't be an office. It has to be.
Like but where would the envelope have been sitting? Like, it wouldn't have been like he was in the concourse talking through a glass window, because where would the envelope have been in that case? They wouldn't have been sitting in the concourse like that. Perfect crime.
I mean, honestly, everything but the whole spending 8 minutes filling out your application and then getting kicked out of the stadium. All of that.
Amazing. Wow.
I'm stunned. That's the best story I've ever heard.
Peak intelligence for Phillies fans at that point. We were really rolling at that point in our history.
And next year we're gonna get to the fan vomiter.
Rest in peace.
Oh yeah, R.I.P. fan vomiter.
So Lidge got his wish, and they did bang Game 3, pushing it back from October 10th to October 11th, thanks to 2 inches of snow and a game time temperature of 26 degrees. The low that day was 17 degrees, which, according to the Inquirer, was a new record that had been set in 1905. Instead, they played that game a day later in a nice, balmy 35 degrees. But Game 3 was a banger, as Brad Lidge probably would have said. Chase Utley hit a home run, but the Rockies singled off Jay Happ to make it 3-1 early. A Ryan Howard RBI and a bases-loaded walk by Jason Hamill tied the game back up at 3-3. Chooch hit an RBI single, then Carlos Gonzalez homered for the Rockies, then Chooch hit an RBI single. Tulo hit a sac fly, and finally Ryan Howard hit a sac fly off Houston Street to break the 5-5 tie and gave the Phillies a 6-5 win, saved by Brad Lidge. And then Game 4. You know which one this is. Lee and Ubaldo Jimenez faced each other again, and by the 8th inning...
Ubaldo Jimenez. Let's just take a minute to remember Ubaldo Jimenez. Just, my God, what happened to him?
He was one of the first of my memory, one of the first Rockies pitchers to be given this Rockies pitcher has figured it out, pitching in Coors. And then, you know, nope.
No, for 1 year, he was excellent. Mm-hmm. And then that was the best year of his career by far. And he ate off of that for years, as he should have, which is great. But man, I would not have wanted to be a fan of a team that employed him.
Yeah. Well, they still employed him for Game 4 of the NLDS when he and Cliff Lee squared off again. By the 8th inning, the Phillies had a 2-1 lead. So that pitching duel lived up to its supposed reputation. Chase Utley fielded a double play ball in the 8th inning, but Dexter Fowler tried to hurdle over him or something, and Utley's throw was wild, putting two runners on base. Then Ben Francisco made a miraculous diving catch in the outfield to save a run, but Jason Giambi and Yorvit Torrealba combined to knock in 3 runs, ignite a Rockies rally, and make it 4-2 going into the 9th. So the Phillies had one more frame to win this series and get out of their frozen mile-high hell. They had one directive from Ryan Howard, and you know what it was. Just get me to the plate, boys.
Oh, my heart.
They got him to the plate. Jimmy hit a single. Chase worked a walk. Howard banged a double to the wall that tied the game. Shane Victorino, who'd replaced Jimmy on the bases after a fielder's choice, kind of stutter-stepped around third and wound up only like 2 or 3 steps ahead of Chase Utley, who was ready to put his cleats in his back as they raced around the bases.
Go!
For the love of God, what are you doing? So Chooch knocked Howard in with a blooper, and the Phillies won the NLDS with a 6-5 score in Game 4. Ruben Amaro admitted he was already thinking about Cole Hamels' Game 5 start when the Rockies took the lead and seemed to have taken all the momentum. But the players all said they never gave up. Ruben said he and his brother David, who are very close, hugged for what felt like 5 minutes after the Phillies won that game.
That's so sweet. I will never stop liking Ruben Amaro.
Yeah, he was watching the game with his brother. Like, that's cool.
I mean, they're a Philadelphia family. It's where they grew up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, following this game, there was, like, look, I don't want this to be media commentary central, but one inky columnist wrote, I guess it was a column in the Inquirer sports section the next day. It included a limerick. Oh. It included a very grumpy complaint about the fact that stadio jumbotrons were urging fans to get loud or make noise.
God.
And that stadiums, because of that, quote, ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Who is this?
He's He said, I'm not doing this. It's not important enough to do this. No. He said another little tidbit where he complained about writers in the press box talking about a NASCAR race, and like this column was separated into little segments with their own little headlines, and what he was complaining about, this, the headline was the race card. I have no idea what's going on.
I don't care if you say it on the air here. You're telling me who this is. I need to know, because the fuck is that?
This is an era where the paper, you know, they also did one of those gag columns where they were running columnists, like designed as though they were, it was an email correspondence between the columnists. And I got to tell you, I get that they were trying to give you some personality in your sports coverage to keep up with, like, you know, pardon the interruption, and keep up with their competition on TV and the internet that was growing. But like the humor is... middle-aged white guy, and in some cases like so middle-aged white guy sports writer, that like they're making in jokes about like sports writing stuff, like, oh, you're not supposed to talk about NASCAR in the press box for some reason. I don't know about that one, but that was, apparently you're not supposed to do that. And like, if you're like a consumer who's not a sports writer reading that, you're just like, okay, is that something? I'm not aware of this reference. And it's, I don't know, it's indicative of the time in which it was published, I guess. It was really, and yeah, clearly you're playing fast and loose with the headlines there. Like, what the hell does that have to do with anything? You're just throwing that in there so people look at it like, what the hell is this about? NASCAR?
The race car.
What are we doing here?
I'm on the floor. I can't. My God.
Anyway, we got repeated.
Anyway, that bullshit. Wow.
We got repeated warnings that the bullpen was still a sensitive spot for the Phillies, despite them winning the NLDS 3-1. But who cares? Every playoff team's bullpen is a gamble. And they headed to their second straight NLCS against a Dodgers team that had just swept the Cardinals. And that's where the Phillies found themselves at that point. And that is where our 2009 story ends on this day. So, yeah, that is where the Phillies were in 2009. That's where the Phillies are in 2019. Please rate, subscribe, and download all your favorite podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family. Hit and Season with John Stolness, The Dirty Inning with myself and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We'll have a special Phillies Dirty NLCS Inning episode coming early next week. And of course, continued success with myself and Liz Rocher. Keep watching. We'll have a NLCS themed episode next week and talk about what the Phillies did against the Dodgers, which I'm sure we all remember. But we'll talk about it.
Oh, and on YouTube, I'm going to be watching this coming week the 2009 Phillies video yearbook. So to prepare myself, it's on YouTube. Just look up 2009 Phillies. It should be the first result. Look that up. You could also watch the World Series highlights if you wanted to feel sadness. So,
Liz, with your feeling sad tip of the week. But yeah, everybody's got some homework. Watch the 2009 video yearbook, and we'll all talk about it next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on Continued Success.